Hello and welcome to Inside Education, the program and podcast for teachers, policymakers, and anyone with an interest in the how, what, and why of teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. This week, I'm speaking to someone who has just embarked on a career as a researcher at the Centre for Evaluation, Quality and Inspection at Dublin City University. Craig Skerritt is originally from Kilkenny and studied at University College Cork before becoming a history teacher in Kent and London in England. During the 3 years he spent in England, he completed a master's degree in policy studies at University College London and became a school leader and examiner. He had an article published recently in the Irish Journal of Sociology titled The Code for Success, using a Bernsteinian perspective on sociolinguistics to accentuate working class students' underachievement in the Republic of Ireland. During the interview, Craig Skerritt discusses the work of Basil Bernstein and its relevance for understanding the education of children from areas of disadvantage in Ireland. He also talks about the time he spent teaching in England. When we spoke, I wanted to know more about the article Craig published, and so I first asked him how he defined working class.
Working class now is a very, I suppose, contested term. It used to be applied in more of an economic sense, but now it's come to maybe reflect more socio-cultural elements. In the paper, a difficulty I had was actually defining the concept. It's not a clear-cut concept at all. So what we've done is we've looked at the social composition of students in DESH schools. So DESH schools are schools that are categorised as serving socioeconomically disadvantaged areas. And I looked at the social composition of the students within those schools. And what we found was that students who came from semi-unskilled, manual or unemployed backgrounds with lower levels of maternal education, fewer educational resources in their home, those types of students were overrepresented in DESH schools compared to non-DESH schools. And typically, if we take England, for example, students who come from those type of backgrounds are generally classed as working class children. So I applied that framework into the Irish context. So I suppose in a nutshell, the paper, when we talk about working class students, we're talking about students who come from homes where there's low levels of maternal education and where the family are of a lower income bracket than students in more privileged contexts.
So would you have been presuming that every child attending a school categorised as DESH would be working class, for example?
For the purpose of the paper, generally when we referred to students in DESH schools, we were acknowledging that because of the social composition of the students, they were of a disadvantaged background, given that, for example, the provision of school meals in those schools are provided to the whole student cohort as opposed to individual students, like what happens in other countries. But equally, I acknowledge in the paper that there are lots of working class students in non-DESH schools as well.
And would there be middle class students, which is the other category you use, would there be middle class students in DESH schools?
I have no actual evidence on this, but based, for example, on literature, based on stuff like school choice, it does appear that parents in what might be considered disadvantaged areas, if a DESH school is the nearest school, they do tend to send their child to a school further away. They're able to accommodate the children in that sense.
And were you looking at urban DESH or rural DESH or both in your study?
It was a combination of both. So, for example, one of the predominant scholars I drew upon was Áine Creggan. And in her studies, she had acknowledged that it was DESH schools in both urban and rural. I didn't distinguish between the two.
So what do we know then about the underachievement of working class students in Ireland?
So it's been well documented that children from working class backgrounds in Ireland, like by international standards, they do tend to be outperformed by more privileged students. What I looked at specifically with this paper was how sociolinguistics can be a detrimental factor for them. So usually when talking about educational disadvantage in Ireland, what generally prevails as maybe reasons for this are issues such as lack of parental involvement, interest and support, high levels of absenteeism, there might be emotional and behavioural difficulties in the classroom. So what I've done here with this paper is I've took a different stance on it. Sociolinguistics was a very under-researched part of educational disadvantage in Ireland.
And what is sociolinguistics? Like, how does it differ from linguistics, or, you know, how does it differ from sociology?
So sociolinguistics, typically speaking, refers to the linguistics, the oral skills, the oral competence of children based on their socioeconomic background.
Are you saying that, say, working class children would use a certain type of language and middle class children would use another type of language?
To an effect, yes. As the title suggests, I've drawn on the work of a very renowned sociologist, Basil Bernstein, and I've looked at Basil Bernstein's theory of linguistic codes.
So what is that theory?
Bernstein's theory was based on the different speech systems that he felt working class students and middle class students had. So there were two linguistic codes, restricted code and the elaborated code. The elaborated code was a speech system that consisted of meaningful, high information, very explicit detail that was context independent, in that it does not require the listener to have prior knowledge behind the topic that's been spoken about. Whereas then in contrast, the restricted code that was far more implicit, vague, and was very context dependent, in that it would require the listener to have a lot of prior knowledge or understanding of the topic been spoken about.
Could you give us an example of each one, of the restricted code and of the elaborated code?
One of the studies that supports Bernstein's theory was by a lady called P.R. Hawkins, and she had a group of working class children and a group of middle class children explain a sequence of pictures like a comic strip. What she found was that with the working class children, they over relied on pronouns. So over relying on terms such as he, she, they, it, whereas middle class children would be far more elaborative and use nouns when describing. So they would say things like the boy, the girl, the car. So, for example, a restricted code might be he kicked it, whereas the elaborate code would be the boy kicked the football. It's far more elaborative and it doesn't require the listener to have prior knowledge of what it is you're speaking about. You can fully understand the context has been spoken about. And very interestingly enough, a significant part of Basil Bernstein's theory of code was that the restricted code is something that all of us use on a daily basis. So for example, when you're speaking to family members or close associates, we often use a restricted code because when you're with people you're close to, we can understand each other, we know the topic that we're talking about. If you're very close with someone, you can almost finish their sentences for them. So middle-class children essentially speak with both codes, but they're able to understand the time and the place on when to speak those codes. Whereas, unfortunately, with the working-class children, they're more confined to restricted code, both at home and then when they enter school.
Possibly because of those terms, restricted and elaborated, they're quite judgmental in some ways. And because of that, Bernstein has been criticised. Can you say a bit about his critics and, you know, what they've criticised about his work?
Basil Bernstein received an awful lot of criticism when he first started producing and publishing these theories. In some places like America, for example, he was completely rejected. What I would say is that for every criticism we find of Bernstein, and even today there are still some criticisms, equally we have enough work defending his work. Bernstein himself often argued that he had been very badly misunderstood because he has often been portrayed as arguing that working class culture is inept and inferior. But Bernstein himself comes from a working class background. He spent a lot of time before in academia. He was working with working class children. He is actually a defender of working class rights and values. And he wasn't arguing that they were inept, but more that their language was maybe socially undervalued. Since his passing in September 2000, there's been widespread publications in his name. I think the volume of publications dedicated to him are probably a reflection of how inspirational his work has been. My personal view on it was that Basil Bernstein was probably a bit before his time. He started publishing this work in the 50s, 60s, and then 70s when it really started picking up steam. His work would probably be better respected if he was producing it initially for the first time today.
Yeah, I just wonder if it has to do with the language of restricted and elaborated, because that just seems to be making a judgment straight away.
It definitely does. Those terms, maybe in hindsight, mightn't have been the best of terms. On just the topic of the language and the discourse he used in his early analysis of his earlier work, Class Codes and Control, There's actually no reference to words such as deficient or deficit in his work. He was often maybe misinterpreted. And sure, I think certainly maybe the use of the word restricted, it does certainly imply some type of handicap, but I don't think that that was actually the case. And I think the fact that, you know, all this time later, 50, 60 years later, his work is still being supported by empirical evidence and his work has withstood the test of time and in many different international contexts, I think that in itself, I think, again, is a great reflection of his ideas and his theory. So, for example, I've spoke here about sociolinguistics in the Irish context, but there's work, for example, after been done in other countries like with Iranians, Turks and Kurds, Mexican Americans, Australians. So there's an international element to it. So I think given how he's been supported worldwide and withstood the test of time, I think it is a reflection of his ideas, and I wouldn't consider him to be portraying that cultural deficit.
No, and you've used him in your own research, and one of the things you talk about in the research is why you think Bernstein's work is not used much in discussions of disadvantage in Ireland. Why do you think that is?
I was really taken back by, I suppose, the dearth of reference to Bernstein in Irish sociology. I would say that educational research, particularly from a sociological point of view, is a very new field in Ireland. I think that's reflected by the amount of Irish academics who had pursued their postgraduate studies in the United States in the 70s and 80s. So when the field developed here in Ireland and also in America where these academics were pursuing their studies, it was functionalist ideologies that were predominant. So the functionalist view being that society needs to function in a certain way, and for it to function in that way, some people need to be in better positions than others. When perhaps a more critical framework that acknowledged and accentuated inequalities might have been better suited to highlighting Bernstein. Like I just then mentioned already, that Bernstein was completely rejected in America, which was, of course, where Irish academics were starting to study sociology. And similarly, then when American academics started coming to Ireland, there's no possible route for Bernstein to enter the field in Ireland.
He was based in England, isn't that right?
Yeah, so he was spent his academic career over 40 years at the Institute of Education, at what was then known as the University of London. It's now University College London. Just then, as well, with him being based in London and him growing up in England, there's also the element of linguists tend to turn to what might be described as foreign and exotic authors, especially on language. So France, for example, was often a hotspot for linguists in these regions to look to language. So again, Bernstein might have been unattractive in that sense. In Ireland, we're very, I think, sensitive when it comes to issues relating to social class. We don't like to acknowledge social class, and traditionally only issues of a certain social acceptability would have been published in Ireland. So I think in that way, given the negativity that often surrounded Bernstein on such a sensitive issue, I think that's another reason why there was really no chance for him to emerge in the early stages of sociology in Ireland.
And what do you mean that there's only some ideas acceptable in Ireland?
Generally, controversial issues that would have displayed people as being maybe inferior to others, they weren't always accepted in Ireland. Like I'd said, with functionalism was the predominant ideology. And also, of course, the role of the Catholic Church in Ireland, they were quite predominant and they often controlled academic thinking and academic thought. And if you were to disagree with any of their thinkings, that would have often been ruled out. So there was never really much scope for someone like Bernstein if we go back towards the 60s, 70s, 80s in Ireland. And it's only in recent years, although he's not explicitly ever acknowledged in Irish sociology in terms of disadvantage, he is starting now to be referenced and cited in the few pieces of research available on Irish sociolinguistics. So I felt that there was a lot of scope here for me to finally bring Basil Bernstein to the fore.
What researchers then have been influential? Who have we turned to when we're trying to understand problems in relation to disadvantage in Ireland?
There's a very influential book published 10 years ago now by Paul Downes and the late Anne Louise Gilligan. It was called Beyond Educational Disadvantage. And that was published around the time that the DESH scheme was introduced in Ireland. So the DESH schools have only been in operation since the 2006-2007 academic year. They published a book of an edited book from various different academics, and that was quite influential in highlighting the discontinuities that often exist between the working class home and the school as a formal institution. And since then, I think educational disadvantage has picked up a lot of steam in Ireland. The Economic and Social Research Institute have been quite predominant in looking at educational disadvantage, and particularly the DESH scheme, and evaluating. So people like Selena McCoy, Joanne Banks, Seymour Smith, they've all written extensively on issues relating to DESH and highlighting the problems that we have in DESH schools and the problems relating to the policies. Academics before them, people like Kathleen Lynch, Sheila Drudy, they published some very influential books on inequality in education.
And then, based on your research, Craig, what advice would you give Irish teachers who want to raise the achievement of children in their classrooms?
So the first thing I would say to do would be to make sure that work is differentiated to meet the needs of different individual learners.
So what might that look like in practice?
Yeah, so in a DESH school, we're likely to have in a classroom mixed abilities, so students of a variety of different abilities, and also in a DESH classroom, there's likely to be multiple different types of special educational needs. In terms of differentiating to meet the individual needs of learners, we'd be looking at having different sets of work for different students. So for example, in each class, we might have a high, middle and low ability group, so that might require three different sets of work for the different students. In doing that, I would highly suggest avoiding the use of textbooks. Textbooks, of course, are marketed at the more privileged students, because in DESH classrooms, we find the students' reading ages are often a couple of years behind their actual age. So not only would a textbook be difficult for them to use, but I think the sheer volume of it, of text on each page, might be too much for them. So it's obviously places a huge strain on teachers' time and commitment in preparing for lessons, but distributing worksheets that are specifically tailored to meet the needs of the individual students in your classroom. And I would advise that in doing that, that each worksheet is not too text heavy, that it's quite concise and precise, that we're very conscious of the type of vocabulary and terminology we're using, and that where possible we use colour, we use pictures, so the sheets are more engaging.
And is that not avoiding the problem then? Is it not better that the children would actually learn to use more elaborate language in school?
No, I think we're trying to help the problem, because we need to start somewhere rather than jumping the gun a little. For example, in terms of developing elaborative reading and writing, what I would suggest to do is for the teacher, when doing written work, that we provide students with some type of writing frame and structure. So you're providing students with what we might call a sentence starter. So if you're asking a question, why did the boy kick the ball? Like with Basil Bernstein's theory of code, with a restricted code, a lot of students might over rely on the use of pronouns. So providing like a sentence starter that starts the children off, the boy kicked the ball because, and then training them and developing them to use that type of elaborative language, so further down the line, after they've been trained with this, that they actually start, it becomes second nature to them. And then obviously once they've made progress, then you can start to maybe take them away and introduce more advanced methods. And then also things like just in general being very conscious of the language you're using towards the children, not taking it as a given that they understand or adults speak. And when you ask a question, being very patient in waiting for a response. So I think all teachers in variety of different schools are probably guilty of maybe being a bit impatient in waiting for a response. So I think being very conscious of that. And it's probably not a case that the child doesn't know the answer. It might just be the case that in a DESH school, the child, it might take them a bit longer to process what it is you're asking them. So trying to be extra accommodating and patient with them. And when correcting any mistakes they might make, so for example, whether it's with their written work or their oral speaking, that we make corrections in sensitive ways that don't do any harm to their confidence and self-esteem. And in general, I think a problem that the research suggests about DESH schools in terms of the classroom environment is that the teaching tends to be, like in non-DESH schools, tends to be very didactic.
In DESH schools, it tends to be didactic, is it?
In all Irish schools, it doesn't really matter about socioeconomic factors in Ireland, unfortunately. A lot of the research suggests that teachers in their schools also deploy didactic methods over reliance on textbooks, and in general teaching methodologies that the kids find less engaging, less challenging. So certainly promoting a student-centred progressive pedagogy in the classrooms is one way as well of alleviating the problem, in that it encourages a lot of group work, a lot of classroom discussion and dialogue, critical thinking. So deploying more progressive pedagogy is one way of doing it. And even just in general, obviously depending maybe on the age appropriateness of it, but maybe, for example, in primary schools or the early years of secondary school, maybe having some kind of circle time or group discussions, the use of picture books, and encouraging critical thinking and dialogue among the children, and getting them in the habit of speaking and expanding on those oral skills.
You're a researcher at the Centre for Evaluation, Quality and Inspection in Dublin City University. What is the Centre for Evaluation, Quality and Inspection?
Our centre is it's an international leading research centre, and we specialise in the evaluation of educational policies, programmes and personnel, and we're particularly concerned with the governance and accountability mechanisms in education, so stuff like the quality assurance processes and school inspections. And we're an active partner in local, national and European projects.
Well, how did you find teaching in England? We often hear that the status of teaching isn't as high as it in England as it is in Ireland. How did you find it?
I think you're right there. It doesn't receive as high a status in England. It's actually been deprofessionalised. I think the last few years there's now unqualified teachers been allowed into teaching. Now there's fast tracks where you can be trained to teach in as little as 6 weeks.
That teach first and things like that.
So you can be fast-tracked to qualified teacher status in as short as 6 weeks, and you'll be paid salaries to train as a teacher. And I think that's probably reflective of the high-stakes performative system that teachers in England operate in. There's severe trouble there with both teacher retention and teacher recruitment. We have probably the opposite problem here in Ireland. I think I probably speak on behalf of a lot of Irish teachers in that it's a very difficult experience to teach in England. I would say probably the classroom climate is very different, in that behavioural difficulties are probably more pronounced in English classrooms than what they would be in even the most difficult of Irish classrooms. And then on top of that, I think because of the accountability mechanisms and...
What kind of mechanisms there?
Teachers operate in a system where they're under constant surveillance.
How did you experience it?
I think when you're passionate about education and you're in education for the right reasons, so to speak, I think you're always happy to do the job and always happy to cooperate and abide by everything you're supposed to do, because at the end of the day, you're doing it for the kids. In saying that, sometimes it feels unsustainable nearly and very strenuous when you have so much paperwork to do and to document for the purpose of holding you accountable.
So what kind of paperwork did you have to do?
There would be extensive lesson planning to do.
For every lesson?
Very, very detailed lesson plans to do for every single lesson you teach. And they're done purely for the purpose of senior management checking your folder where you're supposed to keep all of this.
And did they check them?
Yeah, you get regularly, so there'll be random spot checks. So you could just be told one morning that they want to see your, what we call the planner, and you're expected after each lesson to go back and annotate lesson plans to show that you've been reflecting on your lessons. There were several book audits every week where students' books are not the students' property, they're the property of the schools. So the school will gather up students' books to look at the quality of work they're producing and the quality and regularity of the feedback they've been given as students. So that falls back on the teacher. So you're always held accountable for the academic attainment of the kids and the progress they're making, but also issues to do with classroom management and behaviour policies. It can be quite straining. But I taught in two separate schools in England for just over 3 years. It was enjoyable at times, but it was also very difficult. I realised very early on in my teaching career that my main passion was in academia, and I always aspired to transition into higher education. My own position was that I felt the influence I always wanted to have on children, the whole reason I entered education, I felt I could have a much wider and broader influence on those children by working in the higher education sector. So although I will no longer be directly influencing the students, I feel I can have a much greater impact from the position I'm in now in terms of disseminating research findings and trying to inform and shape or even reshape policy.
Finally, Craig, just a few general questions. Who or what inspires you?
I suppose at the minute, the people who inspire me most would be my colleagues at EQI, Professor Joe Hara, Dr. Martin Brown, Professor Jerry McNamara. That's the exact type of environment and atmosphere I, for the last couple of years, aspired to be in. They're the type of people I wanted to be around. So coming in every day and being in that environment and looking at the work they've done and what they've achieved and matching my own aspirations of where I want to be further down the line, I think looking at them and being under their guidance, that's been very inspiring so far, as I'm sure it'll continue to be.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
I was a big fan of this series, the Inside Education podcasts. I always tried to listen as much as I could when I was in England. My favourite writer to date probably be Stephen Ball, who was
a previous guest on this programme, by the way.
And a very opinionated and, I think, educated man on education policy and the sociology of education. I've read widely Professor Ball's work, both his books and his journal articles, and I was fortunate enough to receive a couple of lectures from him during my postgraduate studies in England.
And finally, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
Good student-teacher relationships. I think as a student, I always appreciated teachers who, as professional as they were and as hardworking as they were, if they could make the time to get to know you personally and make you feel at ease and to, just to take an interest in your life. I think that has a big psychological impact on the student and can greatly affect their willingness, regardless of their ability, to work to the best of their ability and try and reach their potential. So,
and did you experience that in your own schooling?
Yeah, so as a student, that was a big factor on me. And of course, we often, as teachers, we base our own teacher identity based on our previous experiences of school. And that's how we tend to visualise ourselves being as teachers. So during my time in the classroom as a teacher, that was always a big focus of mine, placing a huge emphasis on trying to get to know students on the personal level, taking a lot of time to get to know them, their hobbies, their interests, and trying to basically converse with students during unstructured time around the school site, maybe at lunchtime or when you meet them in the corridors. Although I've left teaching, I'd like to think I've had a similar impact on some students like what some of my own teachers had on me as a student.
And that is Craig Skerritt from the Centre for Evaluation, Quality and Inspection at Dublin City University, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good online bookshops and from libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.